You guys are looking inside the transfer.
Go to any desk, don't you? Okay, we'll open up the committee hearing. And we're doing... We'll open up a work session on 12-57.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee actually had taken action on Senate Bill 1257 at your previous meeting and on May 3rd. At that time, because the Dash 2 amendment, which the committee adopted, needed further modification, and so there were two small conceptual amendments adopted modifying Dash 2, and given the current or the most recent direction from the Senate President, his request is for the committee to act only on amendments that have been prepared by legislative counsel. Therefore, you're looking at 1257 one more time with a most recent amendment, which incorporates all the changes you had previously adopted at your May 3rd meeting.
Okay.
Well, if you want to move it on, Mr. Chairman, I'm excited about it. And where?
We need a couple of people to tell you today.
Okay, the chair would move Senate Bill 1257, plus we have to move Dash 2 amendments.
Yes,
chair would move Dash 2 amendments to 1257. Comments? Objections? Oh. Chair would move Senate Bill 1257 Dash, sorry, as amended to propose the repass recommendation. You'll note that you're not noting here, but
yeah.
Okay.
He's courteous, so he won't want that.
And no objections. So, Senator Steele, and she carried 1257. All right.
She apparently hadn't read the amendment.
You didn't read the amendment? Okay. We're waiting for Senator Starr outside here.
Mr. Chair? Just on the record, there were some concerns raised by a member of the committee as well as representatives of Department of Administrative Services related to some actions taken by the committee and its effect on agencies being able to administer the process as was originally intended. I've checked with Mr. Petty, who is the purchasing manager, and after further conferring on those changes, we both agree now that it does not do anything detrimental, negative, or have any effect at all that would impair agency's ability to carry out the intended bill.
All right, that's on Senate Bill 1257.
1257, I'm sorry. This is the question. Came up.
Very good. We'll open up work session on Senate Bill 827, landscaping.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 827 was heard by the committee on March 22nd. If you remember, the bill basically would exempt landscape contractors who purchase nursery stocks solely for the purpose of the planting of installing the plants but not holding them over or actually growing them from the requirement of having a nursery license. And as part of the public testimony, you heard concerns raised about potential contamination from plants that have not gone through the planting process. And so since that original hearing, there have been a bit more work done involving the Landscape Contractors Association and representatives of the Department of Agriculture and Landscape Contractors Board. We do have representatives here from the Landscape Contractors Board, and I don't see Bill Cross, who's supposed to be here to talk about their amendments. Ken, do you want to speak to the amendment? Ken Trudell, who is the administrator of equity.
Yeah. We're talking about H-17, those amendments. Yeah.
Chair Nelson and members of the committee, I'm Ken Trudell, administrator of the Landscape Contractors Board. You have the amendments to Senate Bill 827, the Dead Zone Amendment. These were drafted after we had an extensive meeting with the people from the Department of Agriculture and from Oregon Nurserymen's Association. And we have consensus. We have needed to be done in the first place, and I think it improves the ability of both the Landscape Contractors Board and the Department of Agriculture to enforce things to make sure that we don't create problems with them.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Cross, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association. We are in support of the Dash 1 amendment, and as Ken Cadell pointed out, a work group was able to meet and draft this proposal, which would require licensure of landscape contractors who either grow their own stock or import stock or hold stock. They would continue to be licensed through the Department of Ag and Nursery. Under a nursery license, but these other contractors who don't meet those requirements would be under then the license Landscape Contractors Board would be informed of the restrictions and would receive bulletins through the board on quarantine or contaminated stock, information that the Department of Ag would be sending out to licensees, so that they would get that information that they should have to ensure that everybody is in compliance. So I think it's a good economical solution for all parties, as well as maintaining the regulatory structure that the Department of Ag needs to ensure the safety of the nursery stock in the state.
Okay, there you go. Comment?
For the record, my name is Larry Harvey. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I think you've already had distributed to you a statement from the Oregon Landscape Contractors. Obviously, Mr. Cross has pretty well outlined the issue from the landscaper's perspective, so I really have nothing else to share with the committee other than to urge you to go ahead and take action. I'm sure all the parties interested will be pleased.
Okay, any questions? Okay, Chair would move the Dash 1 amendment. Any objections, comments? So ordered. Move Senate Bill 827 to the floor as amended. Comments? Objections? So ordered. May I want to volunteer? Who's this? Senator Starr will volunteer to carry that one. Open up discussion on House Bill 2793. We have a series of amendments. Chair, do you want to discuss those?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you should have four different amendments in front of you for House Bill 2793A. The first amendment is the Dash 17 amendment. And essentially, it's those two things. If you also have a copy of the bill, this relates to Section 3, that's on page 2. And it's sub 2 in Section 3. It inserts a provision which would exempt agricultural workers, agricultural labor. And the second change is to reduce the number of calendar days under which the employer may pay the minor special opportunity wage from 60 to 45 days. So if you adopted this amendment, basically it would allow a reduced minimum wage rate at no less than $6 an hour for minors during the first 45 calendar days of their employment. And then if we move on to the dash 18 amendment. And the dash 18 amendment would relate to page 3 of your bill. Under section 5, it deletes 5 sub 1 sub C as well as section 5 sub 2. And by that, the result is it would require employers to pay no less than $6.50 per hour for employees whose earned tip average would be $3.50 per hour or more. So the sections, the prospective elements related to hiring dates of January 1, 2000 has been deleted. And then further, the section that relates to lowering the base wage to $5.50 per hour has been deleted to this amendment.
Just lines 13 through 19.
Lines 13 through 19 have been deleted. And I want to make sure that you've had time to look at these amendments so we're not moving too quickly. And then finally, dash 19 amendment is adding a new section that would be section 7 to the printed pay and growth bill. And it, if you read it, you would see it basically directs the employer to apply the savings realized through hiring the TIP employees under the provisions of this bill toward wage increases of non-TIP employees. And it provides definition for what non-TIP employees mean.
At the beginning.
If using this section, non-TIP employee does not include an employee who has an ownership interest in the employer's business. As I understand, this was a provision, I mean, this was an addition to address the concern of employers or owners of the business achieving financial gain through this bill. And then we have a fairly lengthy dash 20 amendment, which I understand are proposed or offered by Senator Castillo. And I think it'll be appropriate to ask Senator Castillo to explain the content and intent of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Susan Castillo, State Senator from District 20, Eugene. And I come to you today offering these Dash 20 amendments. I just want to explain the origin. They go the opposite direction of what the TIP credit bill does by trying to create stronger laws, a stronger law for our minimum wage enforcement and laws that we have in the state. And I'm passing out an article that was written last year about the issue of the difficulty with minimum wage enforcement for farm workers in our state. And then also, after a forum that we had last fall, a Senate Democratic forum on the issue of farm worker labor, the issue of the need for better enforcement of minimum wage laws in our state was brought up in that forum. And there is a letter from our labor commissioner. And on the third page of that letter, Commissioner Roberts does talk about, it's the second paragraph from the bottom here, that under current law there is no recourse for an employee who has been terminated for violation of minimum wage we don't have statutory authority to fine or otherwise penalize employers who fail to pay the minimum wage. And so I had offered a bill which basically is getting nowhere this session, and so I thought I'd offer it through this avenue today to talk about why we need to do this. And under current law, there is no penalty. There is one penalty that's provided under ORF 650.150, but that provision states that an employee who has been willfully deprived of wages and whose employment ceases may receive some back wages. And since this penalty provision only applies to an employee whose employment ceases if the employer fails to pay wages owed, and the employee raises that issue and receives back wages before his or her employment ceases, there is no penalty. So an employer who is able to get away with paying an employee only $3 per hour, for instance, over a one-year period would save $7,000. And thus, if such an employer thought that there was only a 50% chance of getting caught, given that the maximum possible penalty is $1,560, it would be an economically rational decision to try to evade the law. And we just had some issues raised before us in that forum last fall that really spurred some discussions about why we need to try and strengthen the laws that we do have. In conversations with the commissioner, he had said that it would be a tool that he could use to help him with enforcement of our minimum wage laws. We know that people who don't pay the minimum wage are at an unfair advantage to those who are complying with the law and are making sure that they do comply with all of our minimum wage laws. And so it does address that issue as well. So this is an attempt to try and get at that issue. Anyone who is following the law, making sure that all their employees are paid the minimum wage, wouldn't have to worry about these new penalties that would be in place. And so that's why we're offering this amendment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you.
Anything else? Have any questions on any of the proposed amendments from the committee?
I just think how you want to proceed, I guess.
Well, we'll start at the first amendment, starting at -17 on page 2 of the amended House bill. Any comments on Mr. Chair would move
I move the -17, Mr. Chair.
Senator Miller has moved the -17 amendments to House Bill 2793. Comments? Any objections? Perhaps we should take a roll call on this.
Aye.
No.
Aye.
Aye.
All right. -17s are adopted.
Move the -18, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Miller has moved the -18. There are comments from the committee. Better call the roll, please.
Senator Myers?
No.
Senator Metzger?
No.
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Nelson?
Aye. Dash 18 are adopted. Miller moves the dash 19. Comments from the committee?
Yes. Mr. Chair. I don't know who might answer this on the dash 19, but the last three sentences, which is important to use the savings that result from employing the tipped employee, blah, 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 to increase the wage rates of non-tipped employees. I'd be curious to see how that's calculated. I would assume that if you're in a business, the way I would understand that, if you're in a business that has tipped employees, then all non-tipped employees would be above minimum wage because, I mean, it could be $6.51, but there have to be a distribution. How would that work?
Mike, would you like to come up and explain that?
Senator Nelson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mike McCallum with the Oregon Restaurant Association. Senator Metzger, you're right on. That's exactly how it works. There would be a clear distinction between tipped and non-tipped employees. There would be a record kept as to the amount of dollars that would be realized under the utilization of a tip wage, and then you would have to keep a record that showed that those dollars, in fact, flowed to non-tipped employees.
Mm-hmm. So that every employee who is non-tipped in a tipped environment, which we're talking about, would then have the minimum wage plus whatever the pro rata that the owner would decide?
Senator Wilson, Senator Metzger, that's correct.
Senator Blair.
Mike, this is Mr. Chair. There is no requirement that it be pro rata.
Senator Wilson, Senator Blair, it isn't pro rata, and I apologize if I misspoke there. It wouldn't have to be evenly distributed across all the non-tipped employees. That's correct.
It could all go out in bonuses.
It could all go out in bonuses for the non-tipped employees. It's very specific in that regard. It's non-tip, non-managerial, non-supervisory.
What do you say non-managerial?
It says it can't be any owner. I'm sorry. I suppose it could technically be non-managerial.
Could include managers. I'm not suggesting it wasn't. Hypothetically, yeah. Could all go out in bonuses to a manager. I doubt that would be what they do.
Specifically not the intent. There clearly need to be a rule written around the implementation of this, and we'd be prepared to work on that with Bowie or whoever it would get assigned to.
Okay. That's it.
One other question, Mike. Oh, then, would it be possible under this, or how do you envision this anyway, where all non-tipped employees would share in some way, or could just some non-tipped employees be given that dollars and some of the non-tipped employees not participate at all? I mean, is that...
Senator Nelson, Senator Metzger, the bill's not specific, the language is not specific to that, so it could be either interpretation. I'll tell you, the generation of this is frankly from Representative Gardner in the House. During testimony, he said, well, you've told us that the intent is to stop the distinction between front of the House and back of the House employees as it relates to increases in the minimum wage. And I said, that is our intention, and I don't know how to write it. And he says, well, I'll take a shot at it. Here's his language.
Okay. Thank you. Other comments? Kirk, call a roll on dash 19.
No.
Aye. Dash 19 are adopted. Michael, do you have a comment you'd like to make on any of these dash minutes?
I just wanted to make a brief...
Please come up and introduce yourself. And
Thank you, Chairman Nelson. My name is Michael Gale from the Oregon Law Center, for the record. My comments were addressed to the Dash 17 amendments, and those have come and gone.
Put something on the record anyway.
Okay. I just wanted to make the committee aware that if the intent of these amendments was to solve the problems with cutting the minimum wages of agricultural use, you've only solved half the problem. The bill, because of changes of definition in piece rate and because of changes in the way that Section 653.027 is treated has the net effect of expanding the number of youth for whom the piece rate exemption from the minimum wage covers, to cover 17-year-olds who are not covered now, and to cover as well additional 16 and unders who are engaged in non-harvest piece rate activities but are employed at some time to do piece rate harvest activities. That's very technical and complicated, but I just wanted the committee to be advised that you solved the hourly rate 50-cent an hour problem. You have not solved the piece rate problem as far as agricultural workers are concerned, so we still oppose the bill based on that, as well as based upon the general principle that the vote of the people should not be overturned in this way. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Open up the we're okay with that.
Okay.
We're talking about Dash 20s, right?
Yeah.
Any comments on Dash 20s?
Well, Mr. Chair, I would move the adoption of the Dash 20s.
Senator Metzger has moved the adoption of the Dash 20s. Comments from members?
I think, Mr. Chair, in understanding, of course, these are a little different approaches, and I will say I... even though I voted against 19, I appreciate the kind of direction we're going here, but I think that we're missing the point if we don't look at ensuring what we have for the minimum wage is actually enforced, and that people who are not receiving that minimum wage, that there is not the incentive, which we have based in now, there's not the incentive base to make sure that all minimum wage employees are paid. And I think it's critical, and I think there's, the Dash 20s address this issue, is to making sure that we do enforce the minimum wage rules that we have now. And there's not an incentive for an employer, and we're always talking about the minority, we're not talking about the majority of employers, to perhaps pay under minimum wage because they don't have those penalties. Personally, I'd like to see a combination of some of these, both of these things, and we might have something even better. But in lieu of that, I think the Dash 20s address a more significant problem right now, and that is to make sure that we do enforce the will of the voters and make sure that minimum wages does prevail in all institutions in the state. I think it's if we're going to do something on this bill, that this is the best thing that we can do for workers.
Further comments? The chair would oppose the Dash 20s just on the basis that I know that there is a significant piece of legislation that has some pretty far-reaching effects, and in the discussion and the comments and the testimony received on this bill that I feel would be contrary to the purpose and intent of the House Bill 2793 as proposed to us. Further comments? Clerk will call the roll on the Dash 20.
Aye.
Aye.
No.
No.
No. Dash 20 amendments did not pass. Senator Miller has moved House Bill 2793 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a D-PAC recommendation. Comments from the committee?
I would say this, Mr. Chairman, that in light of what Mr. Dale said, I'd be interested in further analysis of that section, perhaps some analysis by the principal sponsors of this bill to see whether or not it had the intended effect. In the event that it needs additional work to cause the language to comply with the intent, I certainly wouldn't resist having it before us again, but I think in the absence of that analysis, sending it forward makes sense, and we'll find out in the next couple of days how accurate or whether or not there is another interpretation of what Mr. Dale said. And as you know, lawyers frequently have different opinions.
Hard to
know.
That's hard to
do. Yeah.
Further comments? Clerk will call the roll.
No.
No.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. Senator, House Bill 2793 has amended to the floor of the Senate. Senator Starr, would you like to carry this?
Mr. Chair? Yes. Okay, notice of the possible minority report.
Okay, and it's joined by Senator Beyer. Please note that the possibility of the minority report being filed, Senator Metzger and Senator Beyer.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I have the privilege today of visiting in the Capitol my granddaughter, Andrea Starr, and her friend from Silverton. They are here as pages in the House, and they have a little free time this afternoon, so they're over here.
Oh, wow. Welcome to the committee. You're seeing some pretty heavy-duty things going on here. So I appreciate the fact that you're here. If you have any questions, please contact Senator Starr. Okay, we're opening up the public hearing on House Bill 2056, Representative Benson. Okay. Welcome, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Nelson, and members of the committee. I'm bringing you a proposed amendment to this bill, and would ask your consideration of it. I'm also handing out to you a copy of a letter that I just received. By fax this morning, as you would see at the top of the letter. And my apologies to the members of this committee. The constituent, I think, was sending the letter to me and making the assumption that the bill was being heard apparently on the House side. And please do not hold it against the constituent. If you wish to hold it against the representative, if there's an error there, that's fine, but not against the constituent.
We're a tough committee. We'll mark that up.
Okay. This issue arises in relation to this. The House had this bill, and we passed it out with raising the construction bond from $10,000 to $15,000. And my amendment is proposing that be raised from up to $100,000. My reason and my constituents' reason for this are relatively simple, and let me just kind of recap the history on this issue for you. There was a contractor in Pendleton and Hermiston built a number of houses. And there were four houses built in Pendleton where the liens against the houses were well in excess of the $10,000 limit that was there on the bond at the time. In fact, the first house that had a $9,000-some-odd lien on it was first one in line, and they wiped out the whole bond. The other people then are sitting with no place to go except to civil court. The amounts range from $20,000 to, in the case of the Hermiston House, up to $100,000 in liens. The reference sometimes is made that there's obviously a recourse to the civil courts. Litigation has been filed in civil courts, was filed in August, and the Reverend Oliver here is indicating that his best guess now will be that it'll be somewhere around next September at the earliest possible time before they'll get a trial date. Whether they're able to recover anything there at that point is another question. In the meantime, Some of the people involved in this are at some risk of having the mortgage company foreclose on them because of their inability to come up with the necessary money. I recognize and appreciate that there will be substantial opposition to this measure from the contractors, and I genuinely appreciate their position. But I think that it's an issue that I would like very much for the committee to hear and to consider. Whether you accept my amendment or whether some other resolution can be reached by working together with the contractors group is, you know, I'll leave up to the wisdom of the committee. I appreciate very much, Senator Nelson, the opportunity, Mr. Chair, to bring this to you at something of a late date, and would be happy to answer any questions that
Was this the Heritage Land Company? Is that the contractor that was involved?
I think so.
Representative Jensen, you have an idea of on increasing the bond to $100,000 in terms of the cost to the contractor, what difference that might be?
I expect that there be some difference in the cost of the bond. I suspect the biggest problem would be whether or not the bonding company would issue the bond to a contractor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the argument probably is going to be that people desiring to get into the business may be discriminated with that because it may be difficult for them to get a $100,000 bond. And I probably shouldn't be, you know, speaking for them, but that's my understanding of the.
Appreciate your honesty. Yeah.
Sure. Representative Jensen, do you have any idea of how many times in the course of a year that the $10,000 bonding limit was exceeded or has been exceeded by claims against the bond?
Senator Starr, no, sir, I'm sorry. I excuse me, but Chair, Senator Starr, I'm sorry, I did not have any idea. And I, if I could just continue a little with that, I would, you know, I would assume Pendleton, Hermiston, relatively small areas, that if this kind of problem exists there, I'd be surprised if it didn't exist elsewhere. But I may be completely wrong on that. Thank you.
Okay, further questions? Thank you. John Powell and Ken Cadell, do you want to?
Thank you very much, Chair, for the opportunity to bring this, and thank you for your consideration deliberation, Bob.
We'll let you know where we're at with this thing. If something good enough. Thank you. Welcome, gentlemen. Who wants to start? Ken, you want to start?
Chair Nelson, members of the committee, I'm Ken Cudell, and have my other hat on. I'm the administrator of the Construction Contracting Board. The information, have a chart in the information that's there showing the claims that went against bond and did not get paid in 1997-98. And you may want to look at that from the standpoint of the number of parties. The chart is complete to this degree. It does not show all of the claims that were filed. About 5,000 claims filed during the year, and about 1,500 of those reach the point of where we issue a final order on them. So the other claims were resolved in a fashion that that the parties had some sort of satisfaction and didn't ask for a hearing. If you look at this chart, and it would be the one that's in the long form to show what the shortfall is, the 1997-98 claim homeowner statistics, and look to the right-hand side of that, and you will see the number of contractors with the number of claims that did not get paid in full.
We're on page 3, is that?
Yes. The upper right-hand part of that, if you look, for instance, the contractor categories are, there are two categories of general, the third line down would show $1.4 million shortfall, but that was against 104 contractors with 194 claims. And I haven't seen the proposed amendments, but I'm assuming his representative was talking about amending for general contractors rather than all contractors. So it would be that number in general contractors we're talking about, then that would have an impact on over 20,000 to 44,000 contractors would.
Okay.
Would have
I don't know exactly. I haven't really studied the proposed amendments. We're not going to move the bill today anyway, so that'll be an opportunity to talk about it and see what's going on.
Could I draw your attention to one of the items on this bill? If you look down then at the lower part of this, you will see then if the bond were increased to 15, 10, and 5 as we're proposing in 2056, then the shortfall then would be reduced to that amount that's in the center of instead of $1.4 million for general contractors, it would be reduced to $966,000. Instead of 104 contractors with 194 claims, it would be 51 contractors with 126 claims. So obviously we don't get all the way there, but one of the things that you need to look at too is you'd almost have to have a bond as the representative was proposing to get there, and that has other problems with it, because now you get to some cases where the shortfall is large, but the numbers are small. You're going to end up with, say, 25 contractors that cause a two-thirds of the shortfall that we have.
Okay.
We could somehow find out who the 25 contractors are going to be and require them to have the $100,000 bond and nobody else.
Ah.
We got a great system.
John.
Chairman, my name is John Tollison, contractor planning and insurance company. Mr. Chairman, the Representative Jensen did such a good job on thinking about hiring. He basically explained to you the trade-offs by going to a bond of the magnitude of $100,000. And it's the equivalent, basically, of asking for a loan in terms of underwriting standards. And so it would significantly limit the number of contractors who are eligible for that high of a bond standard. The bond, there's always controversy surrounding the face value of the bond and recovery. The issues tend to narrow to the fact that the bond really has two functions. One is assuring the public that at least these people pass some asset test. And the bill before you proposes that goes from $10,000 to $15,000 for general contractors. So there's some asset test there, and that asset test applies to new entrants as well as people who've been in business for quite a while. The second thing it does is provides at least some money for recovery where somebody has been wrong due to a breach in a contract or an agreement. The balance, then, of this act is to try to merge those two concepts. On the one hand, you're setting a bar for entry, and on the other, you're trying to provide some form of recovery outside of what consumers of other goods and services have to rely only on the courts for. And there are millions of transactions in commerce every day in the state, and in some of them, very small percentage, in every area, somebody gets burned. And in this area, at least there's some source of recovery. In many areas of commerce, there is none, other than going after somebody in a court. So the balancing act is to try to find that bond level whereby you create some test to people entering, and at the same time, you don't prevent entry into something like contracting, which competition is important, and secondly, right now at least in the marketplace, it's hard to find enough contractors. So that tends to be the balancing act when trying to establish a bond value. And we can try to help you in terms of what strain would be put on the system at different levels.
Okay, thank you. Question? Mr. Senator.
John, what's the sort of range of costs for a $15,000 bond for a contractor?
Mr. Chairman, it would probably average $250 a year.
It's really not, the term is really not the price or cost of the bond. It's the assets that need to be present in the contractor to get a bond?
Chairman, Representative Byer, principally, yes. However, contractors are of all sizes And also, I think most of us conjure up our mind when we think about a contractor as somebody with shiny pickups and lots of equipment, people working for them, and wham, bam. There are a lot of people in business where $250 or $500 does matter to them. And I think we forget about that sometimes, because this is only obviously one thing they have to have, one arrow in their quiver to succeed in this business. They've got all kinds of other costs. So we find it very competitive, and the consumer, in this case the contractor, does in fact shop diligently, even though that is not a real high annual cost.
Any question?
I have questions. Go ahead.
Ken, what's the license registration cost to general contractor?
Nelson, Senator Beyer, the cost, there are two costs, two different costs, one for a residential and limited contractor. The general contractor is $95, the contractor is $80, but they have to pay a two-year fee, so it's double that amount. The biggest cost to a contractor is going to be the liability property damage insurance, as far as requirements of being set requirements of being a contractor. The three things they have to have is the money to pay for the registration, they have to have a bond, and they have to have the insurance. And without all three of those, we won't register them. Obviously, they have other costs, but liability insurance generally will be their biggest cost.
Do you have an idea what that is, sir?
Chairman, I don't know for a contractor, but I'll try to find that out for you and give you a ballpark.
So I should probably help with that a little bit.
Ranges all over the place. I'm a roofing contractor, so I pay a little higher liability insurance than most other contractors. But in the past 5 years, I've paid from $5,700 a year to $1,250 a year for the same coverage. So there's a big variation in the market out there. And it's interesting that you can still find bargains. I have concerns about raising this bonding limit myself. We look at what going from 10,000 to 15,000 does for recovery to the owners. Out of 1,000,004, we've recovered actually, in fact, less or about $400,000 by raising that limit. And we're raising that limit on, as I think Ken told us, 22,000 contractors in order to recover $400,000 to the owners. Most of the claims are settled by the contractors themselves. And in 20 years of being in business myself, I've had cause to settle a number of claims, but my bond has never been utilized in all of those years. I just, I can, on the one hand, understand that with inflation, we're going to at some point want to raise the limits on those bonds, but I don't see that we're at that point personally myself. I think that the $5,000 and $10,000 limits that we're working under today pretty well covers those claims that are being made.
Yeah. Here we come. Thank you much, very much. Diana Madrietti. Diana, are you? Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Ken Nelson, members of the committee. I couldn't really plan on testifying today because I wasn't aware of Representative Jensen's amendment, but briefly I'd like to say I'm with the Oregon Remodelers Association. We represent remodelers in the state. And someone from the homebuilders was in the back joking about how this would pretty much decimate our entire membership. And I think that if we were to raise it to this high of a level, we pretty much would lose most of our members. And our members are those modelers that feel responsible enough to participate in a professional association. So if our members are gone, then there's those modelers out there as well who aren't part of the professional association that would also be gone. The one thing I would like to say is that we've worked really hard with the industry stakeholders this session, as well as with Mr. Cadell and the CCU board, to really come up with some fixes for some of these problems, because we do realize that there is a small percentage of people out there who are creating havoc on homeowners and consumers, and we want to continue to work with that, but we really hope that you'll take into consideration what this would do to our industry.
Sorry about
it.
Assumption is the higher bond level would eliminate a lot of the members because of the added cost or their inability to
get that. Representative Jensen mentioned that it would be kind of a gatekeeper and keep a lot of people out of the industry. That is partially our concern, but also too, you have to realize, especially remodelers, are smaller business owners. I'm sure that Senator Starr can understand that. We don't have a lot of members who are the Tom Kellys, the people that the names you recognize. You know, you're talking about Goose Hollow Window and Deluxe Flooring, and these are like 2 and 3 people businesses, and so they really don't have the liquid assets to obtain a $100,000 bond.
Okay. Further questions? Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on at about 2056, I guess with a comment to the parties involved, and maybe contact Representative Jensen and talk about the figures and see what we want to work about. We're going down the line now. Coming up a public hearing on House Bill 2773. Excuse me. 2733. And let's see, who do we have signed up to help to go to here? Come on up. Kevin Scott, okay. Welcome, Ken, go right in.
This is one of our bills, and we had Scott Berry with the Oregon Building Industry Association. We had worked with Construction Contractors Board and Kenny Cabell in picking up the bill that they would have liked to introduce, but because of the time limits to place on the Construction Contractors Board in terms of introducing their legislation, they did not, and we certainly support this bill and obviously have introduced it. But in short, the bill would allow for a general contractor to file a claim against a subcontractor for an additional 60 days after the 1 year. A quick example might be someone, a general contractor, has hired a subcontractor to do some tiling in the bathroom. The tiling is finished. The consumer has 1 year to file a claim against the contractor. The consumer waits until the last few days of that 1 year and then files a claim. And the general contractor is then basically stuck to complete the work of the subcontractor who did a poor job. This would allow that general 60 days to file a claim against that subcontractor from the original consumer claim.
Ken?
Turn off from members of the committee. Ken Cudell, Administrator of Construction Contractors Board. The amendment proposed here is one that for whatever reason, the small amendment always got attached to a bill that never made it to the House or the Senate, one or the other, in the past. It's been a problem for years. We just haven't got it fixed. It's kind of a fairness thing. It's a general and the sub ought to be sitting down together and resolving this issue, but the subcontractor is off the hook under the current law once the 1 year is done. The bill fixes that. It passed out of the House by 60-0 vote.
Okay.
Good bill should pass.
Okay. We'll close the public hearing on 2733 and open up a work session, and we'll go. amendments. The chair will move the House Bill 2733 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Comments? Objection? So ordered. Anyone want to volunteer to do that? I don't know if you want to volunteer. Senator Metzger. Then we'll have this hearing on 2578, telecommunications provider. I think it's Mark. Paul Kelman and Shelly Jensen. Thank you for being patient. Get all the time and go. The things are all that way.
Chair Nelson, members of the committee, I'm Mark Hellman of the Public Utility Commission. The commission supports passage of the A and Grove South Bill 2578. The bill broadens the commission's funding base to include competitive telecommunications providers. The commission believes that this has merit. And we'd like to note our appreciation for GT's willingness and efforts to develop a bill that we both could support. Currently, the Commission receives gross revenue fees in part from four large telecommunications utilities and 18 small incumbent telecommunications utilities. Co-ops and certified competitive providers do not provide Commission funding. This bill would broaden our funding to include customers of all certified competitive providers. Radio common carriers and co-ops are not defined as telecommunication providers for purposes of this bill. We have attached a discussion on the key provisions of the bill that talk about what it does, why it's important, and why the commission believes that those provisions are fair and reasonable.
Thank you. So.
Shelly Jensen, Regulatory and Governmental Affairs Manager for GTE, and I just wanted to say that we are also in support of this bill. We think in a competitive environment it spreads the cost of the PUC administration more fairly, and we hope you'll support it.
How much is this going to generate, or what's going to be the
change? No, it doesn't make any change in the amount generated. It just currently the fees are assessed against incumbent providers, and this allows it to be spread to competitive providers also. And also, if a provider chooses to, they can break it out of their rates as a separate item on the bill.
Pass on to customers. Is there any comment on this bill? Thank you, I guess. Anybody else want to testify on these things? We're going to find out. I see some nice telecommunications people back there. They all seem to be happy with this one. Close the public hearing. House Bill 2527, open up a work session on 2527. The chair would move 2527 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Comments? Objections? Hearing none? So, carrier. You can find the telecommunications.
The guru.
The guru.
Touchstone.
No, it's like the public hearing. Open up a public hearing on House Bill 2669 and call my city. Welcome, Mike.
Good afternoon. My name is Mike Dewey, representing Lloyd & Keeble Telecommunications Association, or the trade association of the cable companies. House Bill 2669 sets the maximum late fee on cable service, and if this bill would have passed, the fee on delinquent accounts may not exceed 5% of the unpaid balance, or $6, whichever is greater. We did provide in the bill disclosure on each statement that a late fee may be assessed, and prior to assessing a late fee, that the cable company must provide written notice to the subscriber. Section 3, Sub 3 also provides the time frames before a late fee may be imposed. Senator Metzger, I apologize when I talked to you yesterday about the 27 days. I insinuated to you that there was a 37-day window. It's actually a 27-day window, so I wanted to make sure I corrected that as we talked about this bill yesterday. Oregon statute does not limit late fees for cable operators. My Visa credit card, I guess it's kind of my fault, the late fee I found out recently is $29, and the balance that is irrelevant. Last session I worked on a bill dealing with credit card banks. They told us though they were not competitive, and this bank was thinking about moving to South Dakota where there were no limits on late fees. And the fee at that point in time maximum was $10, and that was moved to $15. We are, quite frankly, asking for this legislation because there have been a series of lawsuits filed across the country on late fees, specifically targeting TCI cable. And in Polk County and Circuit Court, there was a suit filed in December of 97. And this is on a very slow track because the case has not been heard. I understand, according to the time frame, it will not be heard for some time. Basically, what is occurring is that the individual that filed the late fee and the lawyers are looking to develop a class action lawsuit. That is the basis of the suit. Obviously, the damages would be very small if it involved a plaintiff and the cable company. So what we're trying to do, quite frankly, is just preempt the lawsuits, if you will, at least in Oregon, and bring to you what we think is a fair, reasonable late fee for cable companies in Oregon. Let me say, with regard to the actual defense for these claims from the plaintiff's side, there are basically two arguments. One is illegal liquidated damages, that is, that the fee is unreasonable, and the other is that there is constructive fraud. What that means is that we are a quasi-monopoly and we have a higher duty, if you will, to have a lower late fee similar to an electric utility or a telephone company. Those are the defenses that are asserted throughout the country with regard to these. The cable companies, quite frankly, are winning these lawsuits, although on the East Coast there was a judge that found for the plaintiffs and said that the late fee at the time should be 32 cents for the cost of the stand. And we think it is much higher than that. Currently in Oregon, most of the cable companies on average are charging $5. And a number of states recently have enacted legislation similar to this, again, to try and preempt these lawsuits. And I want to make sure that we understand that we do not have a decision. It's not similar to the U.S. West situation in terms of the middle of a lawsuit or an appeal. This is a lawsuit that has been filed. We would argue that with regard to this, again, it's fair, but our situation is a little bit different. There have been national studies looking at the various costs, and I won't get into the various accounts that you look at, but depending on how you put together the study, the late fee, according to this study, would either be $4.80, $7.50, or $10.10, depending on all of the costs that are involved. With regard to the cable company, what's important is, in terms of one of the constituents, in terms of how you would collect the late fee, is you'd have to, many times you have to go out, literally take a truck out when you disconnect. It's not like somebody going to Nordstrom's, buying something, and then you continue to get bills. At this point in time, you would go out and disconnect and try and collect the late fee. Let me say, though, in many cases, the company would waive the late fee if the person was willing to bring their account to balance up to the current fees, if you will, because we want to keep those customers, as you're well aware, the best customers, the customer we have today in a competitive environment. So we think that it's an appropriate way of dealing with what is going on in our industry today. We think it's equitable for the consumer in terms of, one, it's reasonable, And two, you really have what you don't have this in, as I look at other statutes. We set up a time frame by which, one, the late fee can be imposed, and secondly, before we impose the late fee, we must provide written notice. And I think that's something, clearly they don't do that with my Visa card. So that was something that we thought was appropriate if the legislature was to intervene. Now, there are some arguments that utilities, if you will, the electrics and the telephones, have a lower late fee. We would argue that it's a little bit different turning off television service than someone's power in the winter or telephone service at any time of the year in terms of emergencies. And also, probably, and I'm not sure if this is the case, but those fees probably end up in the regulated rates anyway. And what we want to do is avoid putting these into rates. We would just as soon collect those from the individuals. You do have, I believe, a letter from the City of Portland opposed to the bill, in part asserting that this is a local concern. We know of no jurisdiction that has imposed requirements of this kind. And I'm kind of surprised that they would look at it, because in Portland it is a $5 fee. There is no limit today, and six seems to be reasonable as far as we're concerned. The bill passed overwhelmingly in the House, and we look forward to having it pass in the Senate and setting up with a late fee that we think is very reasonable. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Yeah, I do have a question. Mike, I just, as you say, got this letter from the City of Portland. And there was an item, I know we hadn't previously discussed, I think it's rather interesting, and I'd like to have your comment on it. It talks about, under this plan, because of the fact that cable is paid in advance, that is a different situation than we talked about, where it said there could be a situation where you're actually charging a late fee, the fee, for services that haven't been rendered yet. And I was wondering about your thoughts on that, and whether it would be more appropriate to have that set up for services that have been rendered and not the ones that haven't been.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Metzger, in anticipating that question, and we didn't have that discussion, but nonetheless, first of all, the reason that we imposed a fee, if you will, a month in advance is we have found if we didn't do that, when people disconnect and leave, that is literally uncollectible, because they have consumed the service, if you will, in it being an intangible. Basically, notwithstanding this bill today, you'd have the same situation where cable companies do not do that today. So what I'm saying is, by virtue of not passing this bill, we will still collect 1 month in advance, and we could do that today if we chose to. Cable companies do not do it. There has not been, to my recollection, anybody that's called our office to say this is unfair, the late fee has been assessed on something that I've already paid for. We don't do it, and I can't imagine any company would do it.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you for your time.
If we have from the City of Portland, somebody I want to testify. We have the letter that you you're observing, man.
Go ahead, go.
Okay.
Mike, could you just address the issue of what's special about the $5 or $6 and 27 versus 35 days that you support?
Sure. I'd be happy to. Mr. Chair and Senator Beyer, first of all, when we looked at the 27 days, again, there are no provisions in statutes. You may have interest rates and so forth, but I haven't seen anything that speaks to the number of days. When we looked at when we talked to the cable companies about would this cause any concerns in billing cycles, in other words, reprogramming your software, the current cycle is 27 days for cable companies, as we understand it. And so that's why we thought that was the appropriate number. Again, looking at my credit card, the cycle is 25 days. So if we are to put something in statute, that is, in fact, a higher standard. We, one, felt it was appropriate to put something in statute, and two, we did not want to have to come back to the legislature. I don't believe that overnight we're going to see cable companies raising that. We're going to say to them, we don't think it's in your best interest to do that because the law says $6. You have to look at it from the standpoint of what are your costs. California's $4.75. I believe Kansas would be $6, and Oklahoma 2 years ago was $5. We again thought that was a reasonable amount.
Okay, the letter from Portland on subsection 3 is the amount of the cable late fee would substantially exceed the amount authorized by the PUC to be assessed against the liquid phone bills. They're not aware of any rationale for this different treatment. So what is that?
Mr. Chair, I think the difference is in part the duty that a monopoly has, number one, and an essential service, and to have a lower fee. When you turn, as I said, somebody's power off, because they don't have the $10, and the electric could argue that it cost us more than $10. But the idea is we do not want to impose hardships on folks. We know what our costs are, and we think we should be able to pass those costs on. Secondly, I suspect that those costs are also in the rates, so everybody across the board pays for those, because at least in a non-competitive environment, everybody would be basically paying for that particular service, if you will, and also paying for the collection of a late fee. So it's in the rates as opposed to a separate situation. I would argue that they probably should increase their late fee.
Any further comments?
Thank you.
Well, we'll close the hearing and open up the possible work session, or no, we will open up the work session on the 26th. Keep reading this off the paper. Possible work session. We will open a work session on 2669. Chair would move 2669 to the floor with the D-Class recommendation. Any comments? Any concerns?
No concerns.
No concerns.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think we should check with that a little farther, or?
I don't see the need, frankly, for the state to write that contract.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other discussion? Any other objections?
Question.
Yes.
As a non-lawyer, if a business gets taken to task for charging a late fee, would their attempt to be heightened by having been regulated in the amount of the late fee by the state legislature?
I don't know.
The sense would be that it was imposed by statute.
Yeah.
Well, if they're imposed, you have a maximum imposed.
Yeah.
You don't have any authority.
Want to discuss that, Mike?
I was perhaps not paying attention as closely as I ought, but it seemed to me that there was some basis of argument in your presenting this to us that because of litigation that it was perhaps desirable to have set in statute a limit for late fee. And how would that help a company who might be charged by a group of citizens of having an exorbitant fee.
Mr. Chair and Senator Stark, presumably, if this were in statute, the $6 as the maximum late fee, then there would not be a defense because I would anticipate that the judge would say that this is reasonable because the legislature stepped in and said $6 or something below that is reasonable. So I think it would curtail losses and would curtail any serious losses.
My thoughts correct in that the passage of this is just a permissive statute because you can charge no more than. It doesn't say you have to charge, nor does it grant you the authority to charge without at least stating that in your contract that the company signs with its customers. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Senator Beyer, contract usually does not have what the late charge is. I would anticipate that the contract would say that we have the right to charge 1.5% or $6, whichever is greater. The contracts provide that we can charge a late charge within those contracts. You are correct that this does not say that this is the limit that is imposed. And I don't think cable companies that are charging, and I'll say hypothetically, $3 today because of this legislation are going to go to $6 tomorrow or January 1st, assuming their cable system works.
So it seems like the issue that you're really trying to get at in the preemptive strike is the massive class action that says you're charging, the company's charging too much.
That is it. And also, there is this sense because of the regulation of the industry that somehow we need to have a lower charge than other producers. And in order to get around that, we thought it was appropriate the legislature step in, and we are providing ample disclosure and opportunity for people to avoid the low charge.
So I guess the distinguishing point that perhaps Senator Miller was getting at is there's no, other than regulated industries, to my knowledge, there's no legislation that says you can or can't charge a finance fee or late fee. And the question that you're dealing with is arising because as a regulated industry, some folks might suggest that you are charging by government fiat more than what should be allowed for a regulated industry.
Senator Nelson and Senator Beyer, that is a defense that is being used in the lawsuits. Going back to, we'll say, the First Consumer Bank that operates in Beaverton with regard to the precedent, they were unsure as to being, this is a credit card bank, and they were unsure as to whether or not the way that their credit cards were issued, whether or not they could have originally it was $5 two sessions ago, $10, and then $15. So they were unsure as to whether or not they could impose something above that, and they wanted to be competitive with other companies that operate in other states, and the legislature stepped in and said, we think $15 is appropriate, so basically you're not going to move. No, we're not going to be moving out of the state because of any change in the late fee. Let me say, though, that we're a little ambivalent because we came forth to say we think $6 is reasonable. We do not have a limit today. And so on the one hand, if this legislation doesn't pass, we did have a company. The company policy was to charge $10. We did not, as an industry, think that was the right number, if you will. It was too high. The perception was wrong with regard to that. on a balance of $30 or whatever, notwithstanding the cost. And so if we don't have legislation, we're back to kind of square one, and there are no limits. And quite frankly, the cities could ask us in negotiations to set a limit, but we're not required to under any franchising obligations.
I guess just following up on that, I'm trying to think through Senator Miller's question. I think if we were not in a regulated industry, there'd be absolutely no reason for you to be here asking for anything.
Again, if you will, I go back to the defense in terms of where the plaintiffs are coming from. And that those arguments are the arguments that they use, that there are franchises that you have, and you have a higher duty.
I guess that gets to the point that you're here because you're a regulated industry and because government, at least perceived by some, has imposed some restrictions on you.
That would be true, and again, if I may, whatever your definition of regulated is, there are those that say, well, you're unregulated because you're not regulated by the PDC. We're regulated by local franchising authorities. So we are clearly a regulated industry. We have to have franchises. We have hours which we must operate. In some cases, if you looked at what we had to do, some of you would be surprised that we would find an agreement of the magnitude that we have. But we have, and I suspect we will continue to do that, to stay in business.
I'm just looking at the other concerns, just thinking about the Portland concerns. There's nothing in the statute that would preclude Portland if they saw fit to say the maximum you could charge is $5 in Portland. They just couldn't set it higher.
Senator Beyer, the way I would look at those negotiations is, as they were negotiating a new franchise, someone would say, well, we think the rate charge is too high. We would like to put that on the table. Mm-hmm. And that would be on the table. The cable company would say, well, you know there is a state statute, but they could say with regard to their franchise, we will not impose a late fee above $5.
But it doesn't, I guess my point is, it doesn't preclude the city in their negotiations over the franchise to negotiate for a lower fee because it's too high. All it does is set them up the threshold. Not particularly different than a lot of other state-local relationships.
Any questions? Mr. Beth, do you have anything to say from the city viewpoint on this thing? Seem to be getting into an area where we're dictating things to
the city. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Beth Vargas Duncan, for the record. I'm with the League of Oregon Cities. The League of Oregon Cities at this time is neutral on this bill, but there are, I have been monitoring it and listening to the discussions. I'm aware of the City of Portland's concerns. Some of the questions you're asking are the very same questions that were asked in the other House when the Commerce Committee was looking at this, or I guess actually it was their subcommittee was looking at this. I believed it was passed out on the day that...
the D's were gone.
Yes, the D's were gone, that's right. I don't know that I can add further insight. I do, just as the conversation has gone, it does curtail local authority somewhat in their negotiations because it would create a statewide law where there is none now. There are some concerns about, or some concerns were voiced previously about the $6 amount. There was a letter submitted by Tony Krieg, he's a franchise coordinator in Corvallis, that I don't believe you have before you, that went to the committee in the other house. And he pointed out, I actually have my personal copy with me, he made some interesting notes that... he said, in their city, they're currently charging, TCI charges a $3 administrative fee on any balance not paid by the due date indicated on the customer bill. He said an assessment of $6 would amount up to about a 53% penalty for not meeting the payment deadline of a prepaid basic cable bill, the basic cable being $11.40 a month. He goes on to say the average cable television bill in Corvallis is about $28 a month. And there was discussion in the previous committee about how this percentage and fee compares to the telecom, which is 1.5% for those, as I understand it, for those regulated by the PUC, or 50 cents, whichever is greater. If you have any other questions, I know there's others in the room that you're familiar with that could probably address their late fees on telecom better than I.
Any further questions? Thank you,
Beth. Mr. Chair, this doesn't sound outrageous to me. I mean, while the bill, an $11 bill, may not be high, the reality is I think most businesses would be hard-pressed to go through the process of trying to send out the additional notice and all of that for commercial residents. And it's not inexpensive to do that preparation work. There's less relationship to the proportion of the bill than it just does the action of women. Again, I would build, at least my observation is they're not talking about everybody jumping to $6, although certainly that would be a fear of people. It's just messed up for such a cap. And I kind of was thinking about it this year. We dealt with a few issues where we were trying to fix court cases, and it would be, since we seem to have gotten through regulation, gotten some the industry into this game, it might be nice to fix the problem before it got here.
Okay.
I'm comfortable with this, Chair. I think it's, if they are not regulating now, they could set a $10 fee. The fact that we're setting a ceiling, to me, is fine.
Is the motion on the floor? Is Senator going to be a no vote on the motion?
I will be.
Okay. Please, for the record, note that the motion to get past recommendation 2659 is carried with Senator Miller as a dissenting vote. And the carrier.
Your telecom.
On the telecom line. Okay. Senator Barr, Consumer protection. Consumer protection. All right, where are we now? We're at open up public hearing on 2782, non-emergency number.
Okay.
And we have Paul Finn, who's a son, and Mark Landau. I thought you were here on the last bill. Well, thank you for your patience in waiting through these. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mark Landauer with the City of Portland's Office of Government Relations. I apologize. I'm unfamiliar with the previous bill, and in fact, I have bunny ear antenna on top of my television and don't know much about cable, so I apologize. We're here today on House Bill 2782, which passed the House, I believe my recollection is 58-0, relating to the publication of a non-emergency phone number on the front page of the telephone book, and I've asked Paul Stein, who is the Administrative Service Manager of the Bureau of Emergency Communications in the City of Portland, to discuss the matter a little bit more in detail with you why this bill is important to us. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Paul Stein. I am the Administrative Services Manager for the Bureau of Emergency Communications, which is the 911 dispatch center for all of Multnomah County. We're the largest center in the state, processing about 1.3 million in calls. And what we're trying to address here and to maintain is the integrity of the 911 system. Being able to have free lines and the availability of operators within our center to answer calls as they come in is critical, in our opinion. And we are currently fighting with the non-emergency calls being placed to the 911 system. In a recent survey, we found that we were receiving approximately 20 calls a day simply to ask for the non-emergency number. What we're trying to do with this bill, simply put, is to move or allow the publishing of the non-emergency number for the individual PSATs throughout the state, those public safety answering points or 911 centers, on the front cover of the phone book, which is the emergency listing page. So it's readily available to the citizens. We currently have our number listed in 5 different sections of the blue pages, and citizens repeatedly tell us they can't find it. So that's, in a nutshell, what we're trying to do. We think that that will help to eliminate the confusion and orientation to the book. We also think that it'll work as far as the public education regarding non-emergency use. using an alternate member to 911 when your situation does not require a life-saving or life-threatening situation.
Just a couple points in the written testimony that's before you. We have conducted a couple of educational campaigns within the city of Portland, for example, trying to get the word out that there is a non-emergency phone number available. Those efforts have resulted in significant decreases in the number of non-emergency calls coming into the 911 center. Nevertheless, you will also note within the written testimony that you have before you that we do receive about 650,000 calls to 911 annually, and approximately 200,000 of those do not require an immediate emergency dispatch. So that's sort of the heart of the matter that we're trying to get at here, is reducing the volume of non-emergency calls coming into the 911 center.
I guess the statute says that the top, two-thirds of the page.
The top two-thirds of the page is currently restricted to 911 only. We have worked, Mr. Chair, we've worked with the industry. We actually have the sample pages already worked out. They've been supportive of this. The 911 managers throughout the state, the state 911 program manager is also supporting this.
Okay, fine. Any comments or questions? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You may or may not know, when is the phone book printed?
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, they are published throughout the year. The primary for the Multnomah County area for U.S. West, the cutoff date for the issuance is in August for November printing. Clackamas County's bill went, Clackamas County's book went to the printer in March. Washington County's book from DTE goes out at a different time of the year, so they vary throughout the year.
My thought was, Mr. Chairman, that maybe it might be appropriate for this particular bill an emergency clause in order to have this idea take effect upon passage of this legislation so that you can catch some additional publications as opposed to waiting 90 days until after we are adjourned, although we passed the bill yesterday that would make our laws effective January 1 of next year. So if there's any compelling reason to get started on these publications sooner, we can do that. But
Senator Miller, I would appreciate that. I was not aware that each passed a law yesterday to change the effective date, and an immediate cost would be beneficial to us.
Well, the way we're going,
we might be.
Yeah, it might be 90 days. I think it'd be next June.
We could do that. We could take the time to not move the bill today, but just have an amendment drawn up for the emergency clause, and I could see there'd be some benefit on that. So.
Hey, one more question, Mr. Chair. Just curious, on the non-emergency number, well, when someone calls 911, first of all, and it's non-emergency, are they transferred to a non-emergency number, or are they just given the number and said to call that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, in the system that we have, if we transfer the call, we actually tie up the 911 trunk to the incoming line.
Okay,
so we refer them to the number. We also have a recording in order to free up our operators, so we actually transfer them into the recording that gives them that phone number, so if they don't have a piece of paper or pencil handy, they can hear the recording multiple times.
And then on the non-emergency number, is that always a local call in the jurisdiction that the book is published?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks. Okay. Now, you feel all right with doing the emergency clause? We can hold this for a day or so.
I missed the discussion. Why do you need the emergency clause?
Simply because of the telephone book publication, we can get more. Well, this would otherwise become effective maybe January 1st of 2000.
Okay, the books are being published now.
I guess
we're talking about next year's book.
Nelson, Senator Byers, they put on a rotating basis depending on the jurisdiction that you're in.
Oh, is that right? That makes sense.
And about a third of them, non-emergency calls come into the emergency line, so that's the
key. Sure.
The first three is necessary.
Okay.
We'll close the public hearing and we'll get the agenda drawn up and just pass it right out. That's just, I'm sure you can work with us on that. We can just take care of that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
We couldn't add a number. We could put along the freeways to call in and report idiotic drivers.
Okay, open up a public hearing on House Bill 2665. Mr. Brewer, you've been very patient again, sir. Maybe you haven't been patient.
Bet you that the pine trees are pollinating today.
They are.
Bet you are. That's why I didn't touch
it. You're better off in here than you are up there.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joe Brewer, Administrator of the Building Codes Division. I'm here today simply to inform the committee that this is a new area of regulation for the division. We have not historically been involved in regulating any portion of telecommunications. It's not been a part of our specialty codes. In fact, it's specifically exempted from the electrical specialty code. This bill would extend the division's responsibility authority into that new area. In addressing this bill, the division will ask the Structures Board to convene a subcommittee to include members of the Electrical Elevator Board to advise us as to how to implement this bill. The bill is potentially problematic for us simply because it's very difficult to coordinate at what point these systems are introduced into the structure. For instance, on the electrical side, many utilities have different standards for where the meter goes, how many feet above the ground, how many inches below the eave, so forth and so on. So, with that, the division is neutral on the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. There you go. Joe, have you had discussions with the PUC in terms of the relationship?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Byer, no, we have not. We worked with Representative Hill on the House side to have the bill amended simply so that it gave us the authority to determine what standards were required. But no, we have not worked with the PUC.
Are there standards in the building code now that deal with telecommunications installation?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Byer, there are some standards with respect to the installation of data lines, telecommunication lines, but they deal with such issues as wire trays, so forth and so on, not with respect to the specifics of the system itself. And we understand this would be an analysis of what the new capabilities in the industry are and what should be included in the one- or two-family dwellings to accommodate those improvements in technology.
I hadn't really thought about this before, Mr. Chair, so I apologize for wandering here, but I guess I do have a little concern to throw it out. Predominantly, the purpose of the building code is safety, minimum safety standards. This seems to be going more into quality issues, and at least with the discussions we've been having the last few months, most of the telecommunications quality issues have been at the PUC.
Through the chair to Senator Byer, in fact, the code in our state is both a minimum and maximum standard. So if we were to amend the code to require specific accommodations for telecommunication systems, that would in fact be the maximum standard that could be applied statewide.
For regulatory purposes, people could do more, but that's just...
Chairman, Senator Byer, no more could be required of builders. If owners of structures chose to do more, they could certainly do that.
The reason I raise it is frequently, as you know, and you get it every day, I just hear it every once in a while, people's complaints, it becomes more of a consumer complaint of, I don't like the way the house is built or these things like that, and the answer was, we don't regulate quality, we regulate minimum standards of safety.
Chairman, Senator Byer, I wish I could get you to answer my phone because of
no,
Those things are true.
I guess I have a question. It says that the director of USHARP conduct a review. Didn't we just pass out a statute in the Senate floor that PUC will conduct a review? I think we did. I think we're sort of doubling up, aren't we? But the PUC is doing that, isn't it?
I don't have real strong feelings about this, but I wonder if we've got some time with the House Bill. If it's worth asking some comments from the PUC, I don't want to put Joe on the spot. I think he's very neutral on it, but in terms of the directive of who's doing what, and I may be comfortable, but if it makes sense to do it to make it in a coordinated fashion, the PUC and the building codes do it together, I'm just not real clear if this.
Yeah, I have that same feeling, right? And I'm sure, are we directing the PUC to do some sort of
something on public?
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we did a bill, House Bill 2577, I believe, on requiring PUC to provide report on an annual basis to the Legislative Assembly on a number of different areas, and that bill has not passed out of the committee yet. We've heard a number of different ideas, and it needs to be resolved. But this, as the staff reads it, is a totally different thing. You know, it's in a subject area. It applies to one and two family dwellings. It applies to telecommunications and public service technologies and how and what are viable standards for those technologies in the one and two family dwellings. Certainly, it may be appropriate to require at least the intent of this bill involving Representative Hill and perhaps coordinating with the PUC on if there's any area of concern. But my guess is since the PUC has been vigilantly monitoring bills and every bill that we've had that involved the PUC, they've been here to testify, and I did not hear anybody from the PUC commenting on this bill. It's probably a non-issue for them, but that doesn't mean that we should not check with them.
Didn't invite them on this.
I mean, does your department all of a sudden you're into a new area that you've never been involved in before? Is that?
Mr. Chairman, that is in fact the case. We worked with Representative Hill on the House side on this bill, and I understand his, I don't mean to speak for the representative, but I understand his intent is to try and ensure that new structures, one and two family dwellings, can accommodate improvements, changes in technology as they occur. And the division, the department would be happy to coordinate with the PUC and have them be a part of this process so that they weren't left out as the committee.
PUC sort of goes from wherever up to the wall. And what happens inside, they kind of be hands off.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. That's the building code inside.
I think there's enough questions here. I think we ought to check the tower. I mean, as the director of the agency or the project, you might be in a position where you don't really want to make it, you know. Is this something that's really going to be good or bad for you guys? Or is this something that can be done? Or is there any value to this whole thing?
I think the study was neutral.
You're putting me in a difficult position. I worked with the owners of the bill on the House side. It was amended at our request. It is a bill that we can certainly accommodate and do our best to try and handle thoroughly.
I'm just a little confused. I guess I was reading this differently than what some of the comments. So I want to understand the intent of all this. It says, when I think of building codes, to establish standards for providing services. And the way I read it was that asking for the code to talk about how these lines are to be installed in the walls or whatever. I mean, that's what I would think of when I think of providing advanced telecommunications, just like you said, you know, boxes have to be 18 inches here and so on and so on. That's kind of what I read into that, is just how they're supposed to be run. Am I totally off base? Or?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, that's my understanding, that Representative Hill's concern is that often individuals will purchase new homes and find that the only way to get a telephone line in is to poke a hole in the wall, much the same as my wife now works at home, telecommutes. We have four telephone lines, and we have two holes in the back bedroom wall where she's got up her office to accommodate those installations. My understanding was that the representative wanted some way to accommodate getting those systems into the structure without causing those problems.
We're going to have to hire new people to implement this study. You don't have any idea about
Mr. Chairman, we did not intend to hire any new people. As I indicated, we'd be going to the Structures Board. They handle one- and two-family dwelling issues, asking them to establish a subcommittee, include the electrical elevator board, and then advise the department as to how the code should be amended.
He was similar to electrical. John Gervais walked in. You think?
So you just go careful and check in with a little more. Is that where we're at with this thing? Just to check and make sure.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Byrd, the electrical elevator board is the board that advises us on wiring techniques. They administer the electrical code, so it is germane in some respects.
Okay, well, if you do it, Senator Metzger, if it says what Senator Metzger feels about just in terms of the prescriptions, do you have any problems with that? We just move it on. Do you have any problems with this one here? Public hearing, open up a work session on Senate Bill 2665. And
this isn't going to cost you a whole lot of money, Joe.
Joe's got enough money now.
We'll make you enough money.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Byrd, the division that did not feel that the impact would be significant enough to require a fiscal impact statement. Again, it would be part of our normal ongoing rulemaking process. This is a code amendment. We run a 3-year cycle and a 1-year cycle for code amendments, and this would be another one that required some study and some action.
Chairman, two six five form of the new pass recommendation. Objection, Senator Miller.
I'm thinking we're gonna have all this new infrastructure in Eastern Oregon, and we're gonna have to be able to have houses that can take
it. Yeah, I'll say that.
They have no houses to receive it because they won't have all the
houses
to
give their clothes.
Figure
it out.
We're done.
Thank God.
Some people see.